Science.
Evolution.
Astronomy.
Biotechnology.
Ecology.
Cosmology.
Information technology.
Genetics.
Mathematics.
Physics.
Botany.
Medicine.
Welcome to SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on SciPod, face transplant, how French doctors achieved a medical first. Pirates ahoy, can technology bring security to the high seas? And to Pluto and beyond. A new mission aims to explore the oldest, coldest worlds in the solar system. We'll have all of these stories as well as our weekly quiz. You could win a Bose SoundDock, and all you have to do is play. But first, here's Donna Page.
Thanks, Bill. The first ever face transplant, which took place in France last week, has the medical community abuzz. Doctors grafted skin and facial tissue from a deceased donor onto a 38-year-old woman whose own face had been severely disfigured by a dog attack last May. New Scientist reporter Andy Coughlin explains why, in this case, the revolutionary procedure may offer the only chance for a normal life.
The important thing about this case is that the woman lost her lips, and she lost the tip of her nose and the skin off her chin, and there is no existing method of maxillofacial surgery that would have given her back such a good cosmetic appearance. But more importantly and more crucially, in terms of the justification for doing this, potentially the function of her lips.
Because moving, functioning lips are essential both for speech and for eating, they cannot be replaced by a cosmetic prosthesis, the way a nose or an ear might be. During the four-hour transplant, doctors attempted to preserve this crucial functionality. And that's why the procedure involved not only attaching the skin and fatty tissue that gives the lower face its familiar appearance, but the underlying muscles and nerves as well.
This is the whole key to the potential restoration of this woman's ability to use her lips normally. They're hoping that by connecting up all the donor nerves and muscles with those that survive on the recipient, they'll be able to, over time, restore the function of her lips.
Doctors say it will be 6 months before they know if the surgery has succeeded. As would be the case with other kinds of transplants, the woman is taking standard immunosuppressive drugs to keep her body from rejecting the donor tissue. Prior to the surgery, doctors also tried another experimental technique by injecting the recipient of the face transplant with stem cells extracted from the bone marrow of the donor.
And the aim of this is to kind of tolerize the patient to the graft that's just about to be put on. Apparently, if cells are very young, as these stem cells from the bone marrow would have been, they're more likely to be accepted by the new host than old cells and old tissue. So the hope is that by putting those cells in as a kind of a forerunner of the real graft, it prepared the woman's body and immune system to be more tolerant than usual to the graft itself. So whether that's going to work, we don't know, but it's certainly an interesting procedure to have tried.
If it works, the procedure will constitute a major leap forward in facial reconstructive surgery. It will also likely pave the way for a full face transplant in the future. Doctors say that could change the outlook for an entire class of burn victims, including those who have lost the protection and function of their eyelids. Of course, because the face is so central to identity, the idea of a face transplant is not without controversy. And that's yet another reason why experts are following the progress of this first ever face transplant with such interest.
Now here's Jeffrey Whittle with a different kind of pirate story.
When you hear the word pirates, the images that typically spring to mind come straight out of the movies, but these days, real-life pirates are a huge and growing problem for maritime trade. In the first 9 months of this year alone, there were 205 acts of piracy committed worldwide, and over 280 crew members were either killed, kidnapped, or disappeared. Modern-day pirates are equipped with supercharged speedboats, large-caliber weaponry, and all the radio intercept technology they need to zero in on valuable ocean-going booty. This week, New Scientist investigates the problem and the way technology is being applied to thwart piracy on the high seas. A case in point's an incident that happened off the coast of Somalia last month to a luxury cruise liner called the Seagoing Spirit. New Scientist editor David Cohen picks up the story.
A gang of pirates homed in on the cruise liner and began attacking it. They bombarded it with rocket-propelled grenades, automatic machine guns, which they were, you know, trained on the crew and trying to board the ship. But luckily for the crew and unluckily for the pirates, the ship had been equipped with these special acoustic weapons, which are speakers, if you like, very high-powered focused speakers that blast high and focused beam of sound.
Amazingly, the crew of the Seagoing Spirit was able to use the acoustic weaponry to deafen and disorient the pirates, which allowed the captain to maneuver the ship to safety. And this story is not unique. These days, a host of new technologies are appearing on the market, specially designed for pirate encounters. These include infrared cameras that can spot the heat of an approaching vessel from up to 3 or 4 kilometers away. Another popular defense is the high-powered water cannon, which can strike at a distance of a few hundred meters. And for pirates who manage to get by all of these long-range defenses, there are strategies available to keep them from boarding your ship.
There's a company in the Netherlands called Secure Marine, for example, which make fences that they would attach to ships called, and they call the system Secure Ship, which is basically a 9,000 volt electrified fence that sticks out at right angles to the ship. And anyone touching that is going to get a pretty nasty surprise and not going to come on board unless they find a way to neutralize it.
Other defenses come into play once pirates are actually on board, such as pepper sprays and other chemicals that make the deck of a ship too slippery to stand on. And if it all sounds a bit too much like a B-movie, consider the consequences for a ship that fails to defend itself from a pirate attack.
That's a very real worry, and just to give you some examples, over the last few years, various large cargo vessels have been hijacked and stolen by pirates, and they've just completely disappeared. Some of these ships are, you know, thought to be roaming around the seas like sort of zombie ships without any identification system, and people think that they, for example, around the coast of Somalia, where the Seagoing Spirit was attacked earlier this year by pirates, that these big ships act like mother ships, where smaller ships are launched from them, and they can stay, you know, at sea for months on end without having to be resupplied, and can launch attacks, prolonged and several attacks without anyone knowing.
But the real concern for international authorities is that a vanished cargo ship might one day reappear in a major seaport or shipping artery packed with explosives to be detonated in a terrorist attack. That's precisely why the U.S. military had recently made efforts to eliminate the best asset a pirate has, the invisibility that comes with being out at sea.
The idea they came up with is we maybe can't protect every single ship, but what we can do is try and find out as much as we can about where all the ships are around the world and monitor their movements. And if any ship seems to be behaving unusually, raise the alarm and focus our efforts on the ship that seems to be in distress.
In the long run, the hope is that such surveillance, much of it done by artificially intelligent computer systems, will eventually reveal what's going on moment to moment on the open sea. And then the movies will really be the only place to watch pirates in action.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we would love to know what you think of our podcast. If you'd like to share your thoughts with us, please complete our short podcast survey. It's easy. Just visit newscientist.com/podcast and follow the links to get the survey. Coming up next, a chance to win the grand prize in our weekly contest. But first, it's time for this week's cover story. From the Boston Bureau of New Scientist, here's Ivan Semenek.
Compared to the other planets of our solar system, Pluto seems like a world unto itself. It's smaller, icier, and its orbit is much more elliptical than any other planets. For years, astronomers wondered whether it was an escaped moon of Neptune rather than a true planet. More recently, an entire population of similar small icy bodies have started turning up at the fringes of the solar system in a region astronomers call the Kuiper Belt. These days, Pluto is considered to be one member of that population, which has fueled the debate over whether it should be called a planet at all. But there is one way in which Pluto is about to become more like the other planets. For the first time, it's going to be the destination of a NASA spacecraft. That spacecraft, known as New Horizons, is scheduled to launch next month. On the way to the launch pad, it survived numerous budget cuts and cancellations, mainly because the key people behind the mission simply refused to let it die. Dr. Alan Stern is one of those people. He's the Executive Director of Space Studies at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, and he's the principal investigator for New Horizons. Hi, Dr. Stern. Welcome to SciPod.
Hi, Ivan. Glad to be here.
So the first ever mission to Pluto is set to begin in just a few weeks' time. How does it feel to be so close to a launch that you've been working towards for so long?
I think everybody on the project is really excited. It's a very special time to reach this milestone.
So now, what is life like for you right now? I'm guessing it's a very busy time, but exactly how does the principal investigator spend his time at this stage of the mission?
On airplanes, traveling back and forth between, I like to say I spent half my life at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab where the spacecraft was built and where we'll operate it, half my life at the Cape, and the other half at NASA headquarters.
Right, yeah. So
it's a little busy these days.
That equation adds up to a lot of time on the mission. So now, I guess what we know about Pluto, you could write on the back of a postcard. So what I'm wondering is, how do you go about designing a science package to explore a place where you have so little information to begin with?
Well, you do it with your eyes wide open. You have to not make too many assumptions. You try to make the minimum number of assumptions and go with instruments that are both adaptable and very general purpose. So we have cameras, both panchromatic and then color, all kinds of spectrometers, devices to study Pluto's atmosphere, sample the material coming off of it. We try to ask very broad questions on these reconnaissance missions and not over-design for what we think might be there.
Right, and it's interesting to hear you call it a reconnaissance mission. So in a sense, this is like the old days of planetary exploration, isn't it, where you've got to just go and see what's there because it's never been seen before.
You're exactly right. This is like Voyager or the early epic Mariner voyages to the planets. I like to call this the first mission to the last planet.
Right. So now the encounter takes place in 2015. If you get launched on time.
You know, during our launch window, the arrival date slides later and later if we slip during the launch window.
Right. So, in other words, if it slips by a little bit at the beginning, does that translate into a big shift at the end of the mission?
Well, it works out to be sort of complicated. The first couple of weeks, we arrive, as you say, in 2015, 9 years and a few months after launch. Then there's a few days when we would arrive in 2016, then a few days for 2017, and so forth. And by the end of the launch window, we would arrive in 2020.
Well, so that brings new meaning to the word time travel. But, I mean, I guess no matter how you slice it, it's a long way away. But I guess by the time you get there, then things start to happen very quickly. So I guess I was going to ask you if you could sketch out the basic game plan for what the spacecraft will be doing as it flies by Pluto.
Yeah, sure I will. Well, to begin, we designed it specifically to make it a long encounter because an early criticism of a mission like this is that you go a very long way for a weekend at Pluto, so to speak. And so we designed our instruments to be able to start about 6 months before the encounter, delivering new information. So we really have a long period of time that we'll be studying Pluto all through the months leading up to the encounter, and of course it just gets better and better every week by week and day by day.
Right, now, and of course you're very far away from the sun at this remote area of the solar system. I guess really this is the farthest planetary encounter so far. Is it a challenge to get images when there's so little sunlight?
Well, it is very, very dim out there. The sunlight is about 1,000 times bigger than it is here at Earth. But, you know, it's rather equivalent to twilight lighting, so it's not so bad. It's certainly much brighter. The sun is much brighter than a full moon. It's pretty straightforward for our instruments. They're very sensitive.
And speaking of the moon, what will we see of Pluto's moon?
Well, we're going to be studying all of Pluto's moons. As you know, there are two newly discovered ones, as well as Charon, the one that's been known for 25 years. We'll be mapping those objects, mapping their surface composition, searching for atmospheres and rings, and looking for tiny satellites that you could never spot from Earth.
And I know our view of, and just to get back to Pluto for a moment, our view of Pluto, of course, at the moment is a kind of blotchy view. I think the best we can see of it are kind of light and dark areas on the surface. Are there any areas in particular that you're curious about, or any features on that planet that you're looking forward to seeing, kind of come into higher resolution?
We're interested in everything about it. And that's as I was saying earlier, you don't want to overinterpret these blotchy features. We also know that because Pluto has an atmosphere and it's rapidly changing, that the features that we see today may not be there 10 years hence, because they may just be snows that would evaporate, for example.
Right.
So we'll see what we see when we get there.
And just briefly, what happens after Pluto?
Well, very shortly after the encounter, we'll fire our engines, maybe 2 to 3 weeks after the Pluto flyby, to begin the path to the first ancient Kuiper Belt object that we will fly by. And then there'll be a journey of a couple of years after Pluto, and we'll make that flyby. And our great hope is that we'll have enough fuel remaining, and the spacecraft will be in good enough shape to do yet a third object, Pluto, the Pluto system, followed by one KBO, one Kuiper Belt, and another.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be an amazing adventure to the edge of the solar system, and of course we know you're very busy getting ready, but I'm afraid we cannot let you go without asking you where you stand on the big question concerning Pluto these days. What do you think, Dr. Stern? Is Pluto a planet or not?
Well, I should ask you, is a Chihuahua a dog or not?
I have a feeling you might have prepared this answer. So I guess we'll wish you good luck with New Horizons, and thank you very much for joining us on SciPod.
Ivan, thanks for your interest. Absolutely. Stay tuned for launch, January 11th.
Dr. Alan Stern is principal investigator for the New Horizons mission. He spoke to us from Boulder, Colorado. New Horizons is the focus of this week's cover story in New Scientist magazine.
Now it's time for Inside, our weekly quiz. The rules are simple. Each week we ask you one insightful question. All you have to do is provide the one-word answer, which you can usually find somewhere in the pages of New Scientist magazine or newscientist.com. Last week we asked you, what waterborne parasite killed 54 people and made hundreds of thousands more sick when water treatment facilities failed in Milwaukee in 1993? And the one-word answer is Cryptosporidium. Everyone who answered correctly was automatically entered in our grand prize draw for one of five Bose Sondok digital music systems. Answer every week for the 9 weeks of our quiz, and you'll have 9 times the chances of winning. We've already given away 2 Sondoks. We'll announce a new winner next week. And just before we get to this week's question, we also have a correction to the November 25th edition of the quiz. The answer we were looking for that week was 1 billion. But as one sharp-eared listener has pointed out, the wording of the question suggests that 300 million is actually the correct answer. So if you answered 300 million, your entry still counts. And if you answered 1 billion, your entry counts too. Now, here's your next chance to play for the grand prize. Our question this week has to do with alternative medicine. The question is, researchers at the Indian Veterinary Research Institute reported homeopathic ingredients, which include belladonna and arnica, are effective at reducing what udder infection in cattle? Remember, we're looking for a one-word answer. To enter, visit www.newscientist.com/podcast. Please send in your answer before 5 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time on Tuesday, December 13th. We'll announce our next winner during the December 16th episode of SciPod.
Planet, life, body, mind. NewScientist.com. From the infinitely large to the fleetingly fast, NewScientist.com. It's your online resource to science, nature, and technology. With daily stories about cloning, climate change, stem cells, nanotechnology, evolution. Your world runs on science. Don't let that world pass you by. Visit NewScientist.com today.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the December 10th edition of New Scientist magazine.
Also in this week's issue, a new drug that reverses the food craving effect of marijuana is heading for the market. It promises new hope for overeaters, but what are the risks? And historic high tech, a look back at the revolutionary printing machine that nearly destroyed Mark Twain. We'll have this and lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission Control. Transmission concluded.